Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com. We are proud to announce that the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast has received a Silver Medal Award for a podcast series through Garden Communicators International. We thank Garden Communicators for the recognition. If you would like to be a sponsor of the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, please see our website at theplantatrilliontreespodcast.com and click on the Sponsors tab. This podcast is being recorded on February 10th, 2023. Michael Taylor is an experienced nursery manager and grower, passionate about helping nurseries improve plant quality and workflows. He is currently working on projects across North America that increase tree production capacity for reforestation, urban forestry, plantation forestry, and wildfire restoration. Michael does consulting work with the Blackmore Company, which comes up with solutions designed for the advancement of agribusiness. The company's automated machinery addresses tree seedling root issues while improving the overall quality of the seedlings. A self-proclaimed tree nerd, Michael enjoys diving deep into the physiology and morphology of plants to understand their needs. When he's not helping people grow trees, he lives in Florida where he helps grow high-end tropical foliage in his family's nursery. Prior to moving to Florida, Michael spent 15 years in the forestry profession in the Pacific Northwest, managing large-scale bare root tree farms, greenhouses, and seed processing plants. Michael earned a Master of Science in Forest Science in Nursery Management and Reforestation and a Bachelor of Science in Forest Management from Oregon State University. Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, Michael. We're delighted you could be with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm really excited. I'm feeling really good. I think this fits in with a lot of your topics.
Excellent. And we want to make sure that all those dots are connected. Michael, tell us a little bit about your background and how you wound up as a nursery consultant for the Blackmore Company.
So I'm a forester by trade, even though I have never worked professionally in the woods. I spend a lot of time in the woods because I always like going and visiting all my trees that I grow. So I got my undergraduate in forest management. I did a master's in forest science in reforestation, specifically in nursery management. So when I found out that foresters need to grow trees, I was like, oh, I could do that. You know, I really enjoyed forestry and being in the woods, but I was like, oh, I could go and grow trees for the woods. That sounds even better. So at the time, I had to bang on doors because internships didn't exist for foresters in forest nurseries. They thought I was strange, and I am pretty strange. So I think it was a good fit, you know. I banged on enough doors, and Weyerhaeuser gave me an opportunity to do an internship with them at one of their nurseries. And that's really where I got introduced to the world of growing trees. So I spent 4 or 5 years there, and then I went to another company managing large bare root nurseries and container operations.
Wow. Now, are you originally from Michigan or Florida?
Nope. I am originally from Oregon.
Okay.
I spent 90, 7.5% of my life in Oregon, and I currently live in Florida. My wife and I have lived there about 4 years. I took a job. It was a great opportunity to work for a startup building a nursery system with a new species of trees that had never been domesticated. So it was a really unique opportunity. So we took that job in Florida growing tropical trees. I learned a ton about tropical trees and grafting and genetics and tissue culture and all of those things that I didn't really get in the forestry world. And then when that ended, I had done a lot of work with the Blackmore Company over time, a lot of trials using their equipment and everything. And when they found out that I was available to hire, they asked and I accepted. So I do consulting work for other companies, but most of my work is with Blackmore Company, and all of my projects are common. So maybe I supply trays or technology to a nursery, and then they need something on top of that, and I go in and I help them with that as well. And most of that work I don't charge for, but it's outside the scope of Blackmore.
I understand. Okay, so Blackmore, tell us about Blackmore. Tell us what they do.
Yeah, so they're a great company. I really enjoy working with the team. So they've been around about 65 years. They were pioneers in the seedling tray. So if you use a seedling tray with individual cavities, Blackmore is the company that developed that. They were growing annuals and flats and said, hey, there's got to be a better way. Transplanting doesn't work very well. And so Skip Blackmore and his dad figured out how to do thermoform trays. They're right outside of Detroit in Belleville. So there was a ton of experience from the Detroit auto industry and manufacturing and molding. And so they gathered a bunch of, you know, nerds together and figured out how to make a seedling tray. And they were very successful at it. And then after developing that, the problem was now we need to put seeds in all of these cavities, not by hand. So then they started making seeding equipment. And the evolution of basically what we have today is out of necessity. And they said, hey, I need to bake a drum seeder because I need to do faster sowing production and more efficient, and it needs to be really accurate. So they've made a lot of really great equipment over time, really because they needed to use it or they had customers that needed it to be a certain way. So all that machinery is made in Michigan. So
would you say that that's the Cadillac of the industry?
If I would have had their drum seeder in my past life, I would have been much, much happier. I always tell people it has all the creature comforts of someone who ran, you know, stood at that drum and ran it for 8-9 hours a day, you know, 40 days in a row. It just has all these little features that a lot of drums don't have because perhaps the people that make it didn't run it.
You know what I find really fascinating, that you can love plants, but not necessarily be connected to them in the way that some people think you're connected. A lot of people don't understand how huge the agriculture industry is, and that having these precision types of equipment take a special mind to put them together. And that creativity that comes with that is a little bit on the edge of the horticulture world or the forestry world. It's like you said, the crossover between manufacturing and the natural world, where you're trying to get something to fit to help the natural world, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love about Blackmore, you know, forestry in my mind has been kind of a neglected industry when it comes to technology and automation. The hort world, right? You can go into a nursery that hardly has people and robots are running around all over the place. You don't see that in forestry. Most people that start forest nurseries do it out of necessity or they do it out of a passion. And there's not a ton of money in it. There's not a ton of forest nurseries. So to develop seeding equipment specifically for the forest industry maybe isn't the best business model in terms of if you only manufactured one part of it. So what I'm doing with Blackmore and why I love working with them is I'm developing the forestry stuff for them. So they have great seeding equipment, great flat fillers, all of these things. And now I'm adapting them to a forestry depth tray. Mm-hmm. The hort world works in very shallow trays. forestry is not that way, right? You're not going to see a 40 millimeter deep tray in forestry. Maybe up in the Northeast, they might get down close to that in the 65 millimeter range. But you come out to the Northwest or the Midwest and you're 6 inches deep, you know, you're 150 millimeters.
Those plug type shapes that are so critical for good plant or tree care or beginnings, yeah. They're finding that the deeper the cell or the longer the cell, the more likely that the plant will survive better than if it's a shallow cell. I know that's true with the horticulture end of things. And it would make sense that, you know, trees would do better in a deeper system.
Yeah. You know, you can go too far that direction as well. A lot of the trials that I've run, you know, why I loved the job that I had in the past so much was I got to run trials for forest nurseries, right?
Right.
Hey, let's try that out and let's go plant those out in the woods and see if it did matter, see if it did change. And you see that a lot in forestry, right? You have people that just tinker and they get better at it. And you need to be able to iterate on something and go, hey, it didn't work quite right this year. Let's change it just a little bit and try it again next year. That depth of tray, I think, is really important. You see it. Forestry wants a deeper tray. You don't see 6-inch deep trays in horticulture because they're going to take that tray and they're probably going to put it into another tray. Mm-hmm. And when you go and do that, well, then the next tray has to be deeper than the one that you started with. And so they try to go short so that when they step those up and stage those up through life stages, that they don't end up with a 2-foot deep cell by the end of that.
Just a quick question on here. You're doing your tinkering and your trialing. Do you ever have someone write a white paper for your work, or do you write white papers for your work? Because I know that you can tinker all you want, but if it doesn't have the research behind it, people think it's invalid. And I think that that's critical for, I know Hal and I look at that, you know, we look at research papers a lot when we're reading and interviewing people, and we really find that to be a critical component of anyone's research, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the trials that we do are what they would, what the industry has coined cowboy science, right? It's you put things out and then you go and you look at them and you go, does that tree look different? Maybe I think that one is a little bit greener. And there's really nothing scientific about it. And then there are research trials that we do. And this year we have 4 large trials that are going on that are going to be, they've already been installed. They're going to be peer reviewed and someone's going to write them up. I am not that person. I did my master's thesis and that was more writing than I needed to do in a lifetime. And I will leave that to someone else. And the reality is I'll pay someone else to do that for me. Right now we have a lot of great cooperators, state nurseries, The Ringer team. Are you guys familiar with the Ringer team, ringer.net? No. They're a great, great resource for any nursery, native plant, forestry. They're a federal group. There's, I don't know, 5 or 6 of them across the U.S. in various capacities and roles. But they're really, you know, I know here in Portland, Diane Hazy, she was my mentor in graduate school. She's a fantastic researcher, you know, done more articles and research than most of us will ever, you know, aspire to. And they just put out a lot of really great work. And a lot of it's practical work. It's not science for the sake of science. It's, this is a nursery. Here's what we did. And did it work?
One more time with that website, Michael.
It's ringr.net. It's research... nurseries, genetics.
It.
Yeah. And if you ever want to look up a topic, they have, I don't know, 70, 80 years of white papers on there, thousands and thousands of articles, and a really great search engine that you can find.
Right. They weren't always available. That they're pulling things out from the great depths of the research that universities have had for years, but they've never been culminated or included in any major data bank that you can go to.
Oh yeah, and it's all free. That's the real joy of it, right? You can find an article by searching for it, and then you can actually read it and not have to pay someone for it. They also have the nursery manual, which is, I think, a 7-volume book series on everything start to finish and how to grow a plant at a nursery. Really great resource there.
So when Eva and I started talking podcast vision right before the pandemic, 2019, March, and came up with the title Plant a Trillion Trees. And we do, I think, speaking with you, it's kind of helping me remember some of our initial focus, which was a trillion trees is a lot of trees. And we will read on occasion of shortages and supply chain issues and stuff like that. Just wondering, how is the industry responding in terms of both a company like Blackmore, but also the various vendors? It seems like, well, I'm going to say already, this is feeling like one of those interviews where I'm going to leave with a lot of optimism.
Yeah.
Not always the case.
There's North America has a massive capacity to grow trees. The South alone, you know, is 1 billion to 2 billion, depending on how you add it all up. The Northwest and, you know, the provinces are, you know, another 1.5 billion. It's an amazing capacity to grow trees, but, you know, that would take us 1,000 years to plant a trillion, right? You know, we're working with numbers that we've never really worked with. And, you know, the way I see my role in this industry is to really help make forestry scalable. The nurseries that we have and the technology that we have aren't necessarily green technologies, and they're also not scalable. When you look across the nurseries in North America, they cap out at really a specific volume. And I'll talk in trays and trees and translate between the two of them. So Europe and Canada, pretty standard large nurseries, 20 million trees. You go to the Northwest, pretty standard green, you know, and I'll talk greenhouses and then I can talk bare root. You go to the Northwest in greenhouses and it's 10 million. Well, those numbers are the same. It's the tray densities that differ between Canada and the US. A standard forestry tray in Canada is a 112. A standard forestry tray in the Northwest is 60, literally half as dense. So you talk the same number, whether it's 20 million or 10 million, depending on your geography, it's the same number of trays, which is where a lot of nurseries cap out. Now, there are exceptions to that. There's exceptions to everything in life. There are, I'll call them mega nurseries, nurseries that are double or triple that number, but those are few and far between. And the reason is our technology is inefficient. Mm-hmm. We don't have, you know, they've capped out at that because beyond that is, I'll call it an excessive workload for most managers and staff. They don't grow beyond that because it just becomes painful to do that. The other thing in my mind that the Trillion Tree Project, people really need to talk about it. And I try to talk about it from every soapbox people will let me on. Seed. A trillion seeds is 1,000 times more than we have in inventory right now. We also grow in a technology that is not efficient at seed. You run the math on an 80% germ seed and a nursery that grows 5 million trees. Well, to do that in the traditional methods that we do it, you're going to kill 8 million trees to make 5. And they do that because greenhouse space is expensive. Every square foot needs to be maximized for its rent for that year. Well, when you have a nursery that's sowing 3 seeds per cavity, because that would be the whole number you round up on an 80% germ, right? The math would probably tell you it's 2.7 seeds, but you're going to round up to 3 because you know you can't have 0.7 of a seed. Well, if you're 3 seeds per cavity, that means you are going to throw away 8 million germinants to make 5 million trees. I don't care how good at math you are, that math doesn't work when you need to grow a trillion. So we need to change the technology, which is really the tray technology. We need to grow in a tray that allows us to move a tree so that we can consolidate a greenhouse to maximize that space. So typically you would sow 120% of an order to meet it. Well, we need to sow 140, but only use one seed versus three. And then you need to take those 20 and consolidate them back, right? Remove all of those empties to where your greenhouse is 100% full, and you haven't wasted 8 million seeds to do that.
I think, yeah, I was going to say, jump in here that, you know, I have a friend who has a cell business, seed cell business, and it's, of course, for perennials. And you think about how that technology has come along so well. You know, it costs you $100,000 to have a seeding machine, but what that machine can do to compensate for what we didn't have before has sent us light years ahead of what they can do now in the perennial, annual, whatever business you want in the garden profession. Now, if you're talking about trees, and because there are so many different types of dormancies, that becomes a problem. Like, you know, you have a 100-day dormancy, say for an oak or a pawpaw or something like that. That takes a lot of time, and you have to keep overlapping to make sure that you have seed all the time of that particular plant to keep the things moving. And that's an incredibly logistic nightmare to think about. Yeah. You know, it's one thing if you're planting an annual or perennial. Sometimes perennials will have a little bit of a dormancy, but even then, it's not nearly as bad as when you're talking about a tree or a shrub that really takes that extra effort. And is that something that you're working with also to try to speed up time?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of seed work that's going on, a lot of great work by a lot of good companies that are really trying to improve on that. A lot of it is coming down to just availability, right? If you look at the mega fires that have been hitting the Northwest in the last 5 years, you're talking about burning entire seed zones in one fire season. Well, if you don't have seed collected from that seed zone, you're at great risk of not having seed to put back on that landscape that came from that landscape. The state governments have done an excellent job in their orchards. Do you know a company, Silva Seed?
Yes, I've heard of
that. Okay, yeah, I've helped them with some nursery stuff, and they're doing some really great work collecting seed. It's a lost art. A lot of people went to orchard collections, and rightfully so. Collecting seeds in the wood is hard. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of logistics. And there's only so many people that can do that work. And the geographies that they're covering are massive, right? State level, you know, harvesting is very difficult. But when you're looking at a massed event on a seed zone that maybe you don't have a lot of seed available, you know, is it worth the effort? My answer is yes. But, you know, it's one of those where there's not enough people doing that and really banking that seed to cover all of us.
So there's a lot of professions out there that we could have.
Oh, yeah.
And we could employ everyone here in the United States, without a doubt. Even school children in high school could go out and learn how to collect seed. They could have their college paid for before they get out of high school.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. I mean,
yep.
You know, it's one of those jobs that's great, right? You get to drive around in the woods and look at trees all day. Like, what better job is there? And, you know, there's a lot of work involved in that, but, you know, there's not enough companies going after that stuff. Silva Seed's one of the only ones that I know of that's really going after cone collection at scale. And it's a serious undertaking trying to organize something like that because, you know, what are the things that kill seeds? It's moisture and heat. Well, if you don't store those cones properly, you just spend a whole bunch of time and energy killing a whole bunch of seed. It's logistics of handling. It's logistics of documenting where that seed came from. What elevation were you at? Where, you know, what road were you on? Take a picture of the tree that you got it from, you know, kind of stuff. The information that they are gathering is critical, but it's daunting to really organize all of that work all in one place.
Now, a couple of quick questions for you here, Michael. One is, does technology stand to assist seed collectors other than garden variety GPS? Is there ways that technology can swoop in and assist with this?
Well, you know, I think like everything, technology is definitely helping, and people are working on it, right? So you'll just see, you know, slash drone seed. They're looking at all kinds of crazy things to do with drones. And you need to think outside the box when you start talking about really changing how we've done things in the past. But the seed processing side is an art as well as a science, and technology is definitely getting better in that realm. You know, you go into an old seed processing plant and they might have a clipper from the 1940s for seed cleaning. Well, there's better technology out there, and people are starting to get better at it as the value of seed is going up. The biggest hurdle that we have in seed is it's relatively inexpensive, right? The counter argument to me talking about 3 seeds per cavity is the fact that, well, if that seed is a penny, you're only throwing away 2 cents. You also have the labor to thin all of that. And my argument would be that you're going to spend more time killing trees than you are making them. But tree seed is relatively cheap. It's not a $20,000 a pound tomato seed. You know, you might be in the hundreds of dollars per pound.
Does seed collecting translate to deciduous? And what does that look like? In other words, well, obviously the collecting part I can visualize, but with the equipment that's used for, say, an acorn going into trays, does that work, or has that become more of a manual thing again?
Well, you can do things to help with an acorn, right? We make what we call a drill dibbler, where it's literally a drill bit on a rail or in a full tray that'll make that cavity for you on an acorn. And it really helps the process. Also, you know, pushing an acorn into a tray, you've compressed all the media by pushing that in. And when that comes out, that radical emerges, a lot of times it'll push that acorn right out of the tray.
Okay.
So by drilling it out, you make a soft landing for that radical to emerge properly and not try to push the acorn out of the tray.
That's neat.
And then we talked at the outset, just for clarification, your work with bare roots. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming off like a newbie here because these are things I've never had to think about before as an arborist. But tell me about the bare root aspect of your work.
Yes. When I worked at Weyerhaeuser, it was at their Aurora facility, which is probably pushing 300 acre bare root farm. It's a large bare root farm.
Aurora, Colorado?
Aurora, Oregon. So 30 minutes south of Portland, Oregon. And, you know, it's a large farm. There's another large farm with a company called IFA, which is not that far away, maybe 20 minutes away in Canby, Oregon. And, you know, there's a few in Washington, a few others in Oregon. The problem with bare root is the soil. Soil is critical to bare root. So the two farms in Oregon are actually on the same soil series in two different locations, but same soil series. It's all a part of the Missoula floods that came down, you know, flooded the Willamette Valley, series of massive floods from an ice dam that broke. And you had these really great deposits of soil. And the IFA Canby and Weyerhaeuser Aurora are on this Candrely loam series soil. So it's called an excessively well-drained soil. Soil management and tilth is really important in bare root production because you need to produce that fibrous root system. You also need to be able to work it and not have it, you know, get compacted and not grow good roots. The other big caveat is you're lifting those trees when they're dormant in the winter. Most farmers don't farm in the winter. Bare root farmers are lifting all of their trees out of the ground in the winter. So it's a process. It takes a really unique soil type and a really unique management style. It would be, from a farming standpoint, a very intensely managed crop.
How big are the trees when they're being pulled? Are they several inch caliper, or are they small, or what's
that? Yeah, you would be a 6 to 12 millimeter caliper.
Oh, okay.
And a foot to maybe 3 feet at the max. When you get too tall, right, your root shoot balance gets out of whack. So you don't want them to be too tall because there's a human max on the root length. A 9-inch root system is about as long as you want to go because someone's got to dig 11 or 12 inch hole to plant that tree in it so that you don't J-root the trees when you plant them. J-rooting is where the roots hit the bottom and come back up. Well, all those tips then grow roots straight up back to the soil surface instead of down to the water.
Are most of these conifers, or are you thinking deciduous as well, or talking about deciduous?
Well, most of the large conifer nurseries, the forestry nurseries, are all conifers. But there's a lot of hardwood production in bare roots still. It's a pretty standard production practice. Although that is shifting as labor costs are increasing. You know, bare root farms are really cheap because you can grow a lot of trees, you know, in a huge space that's relatively cheap compared to a greenhouse setting. The difference is that you have a very small window when you can lift those trees, prune their roots off properly, and store them for planting. The biggest hurdle to a bare root nursery is, let's say you need to lift and package 30 million trees. In Oregon, you're typically going to get 28 dry days in the winter. After the point of dormancy, where you say this tree is able to handle the stress of lifting and packing, and the point where it starts to wake up and is no longer able to be lifted and packed because it's growing again. And, you know, you've got to stick it in a bag and get it to the field as fast as you can and plant it. Otherwise, it's going to kill itself in a bag.
That's interesting because we here in the city of Philadelphia, we use a lot of bare root trees from upstate New York. And those are, and I don't know whether you do use like a hydro crystal or something like that to...
Hydrogel.
Hydrogel, yeah. They use a hydro gel around the root systems and and then they do it again when they arrive here just to be able to store them long enough that they can get planted. But all of us are trained in bare root planting. That's what we do.
Yeah, and that's starting to change. You know, we're working with a lot of nurseries, large caliper tree nurseries that are shifting out of bare root. Because you can make a much better root system in a container with the right container. Right? A lot of the work that I do with Blackmore is around this concept of an air-pruned root system, which is the roots grow to the edge of the container, and then the air prunes them off. So you have all of these active root nodes on the edge where they're going to hit the soil. I call it the chia pet, right? When you plant it in the ground, if you wait and dug it up in a month, it should look like a chia pet, right? There should be white root tips exploding out from every square inch of that root or that container into the soil. That's the best way to establish a tree. The problem with traditional container production in caliper trees is they're grown in a cheap, chunky plastic pot, which is a single-use pot. It's designed with the user in mind, right? It's a vehicle, might as well call it a plastic bag to pick up your groceries, right? It's designed to get the tree from point A to your house, point B, so that you can put it into the ground. The problem is that the roots spiral in those. Well, a spiraled root in a caliper tree going into a landscape or in forestry, or really anything, is terrible, right? You're going to girdle that tree, which is why bare root was so popular, because people could see those root systems and go, there's nothing girdling on there. Whereas in a container, you never know if there's a hidden girdling root on the inside. So a lot of the work that I do in that area is producing in a pot that doesn't allow a root to spiral. And that's really a game changer in the industry, right? It's this idea that I can now produce a caliper tree in a container. And the same goes for hardwoods in a field, bare root, and conifers in a field, bare root. The packing shed of a forest nursery, you might need 200 to 300 people in that packing shed. Well, 2 years ago, everyone got a real wake-up call with packing 300 people into a small space, packaging trees. There were trees that didn't get lifted and shipped to the woods because they couldn't get them out of the ground and packaged in time. So when you look at the ebbs and flows of a greenhouse compared to the ebbs and flows of a bare root field, bare root is starting to dwindle because those peaks are really high and the valleys get low. Whereas a greenhouse is much shorter. You know, you can lift a whole bunch of trees in pots and move them in any condition that you want, versus there's only certain days of the year where you can go out and harvest a bare root tree in the field. So there's a lot of that going on. You know, instead of a 300 person packing shed, maybe you need 20 to run an efficient conifer nursery in a container. So
yeah, I think Eva was referencing citizen tree planting, citizen arborists here in Philadelphia. We really do count on bare root trees because we're handing a 1.5-2-inch diameter bare root tree to a senior citizen or a 13-year-old, and they can do a nice job planting it. So I think what I'm starting to realize, Michael, from this conversation is that that sized bare root is kind of a niche market here in Philadelphia, probably other areas. I'm very nostalgic for Princeton Nurseries and the big bare root operation that they ran, you know, from their outset and shut it down, I guess, in the early 80s or something like that. Hate to see it go away. And I think it'll always be here, kind of like a specialty craft beer or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. Our industry does have very specialized areas, and then it has the mass production as well. And I think both serve both communities. But I'm really fascinated when you were talking about getting the trees out and planting them. I was seeing a machine that was like a vacuum Roomba, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that is working all day and all night planting trees, and someone or something is loading those seedlings or seed short small trees into an area. And maybe by the time people wake up in the morning, a whole forest is planted.
Yes.
By machinery that is controlled in the kitchen of your home.
Yeah, we're working on some of that automation, not quite autonomous at this point, still a manned operation. But the goal is, you know, if we need to plant a trillion trees, we got to look at everything. All the low-hanging fruit we got to get rid of. Labor is a huge issue. Labor in nurseries is a huge issue. Labor in the field planting is a huge issue. There were some issues with the H2B worker program just a couple of years ago, and it had rippling effects through the forest industry because people couldn't get trees in the ground when they needed to. So they were planting on the fringe seasons, jeopardizing really the crop that they potentially had 3 years invested in that time to make that tree. And then they got pushed out into a window when the odds of it surviving dwindled. So the automation piece in my mind, you know, my goal is to take a seed and put it in a tray and grow the tree and grade the tree and then take that tray to the woods and plant in a machine and have as few people involved as possible. Not because I don't like people, I actually really like people, because if we're going to hit numbers like those, we have to use our people more wisely. We're going to use the same number of people in these operations. We're just going to do more with those people. You know, if we were able to plant 2 billion trees last year, maybe we can plant 4 billion with the same labor force and a little technology thrown in on the side.
And I think that's where technology really does play a critical role for our industry in particular. I mean, we're cutting trees down faster globally than we can plant. And we also have that seed shortage. And we do have a shortage here. I think it's 1 billion trees that we're lagging behind.
I was at a conference in Montana last October, and I heard a number of 6 billion was what the federal backlog acres are, which
yes.
is an astronomical number in my mind. It would take the entire production of North America 3 years to plant that backlog.
Right. And of course, worrying about our climate change and the availability of plants that are still here versus those that disappear through extinction, if we are not adamant about collecting seed, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
I don't hate to be a doomsayer, but...
Yeah, I thought I was going to be happy at the end of this podcast.
Oh, I think you should be, because I think, you know, if we can get better at our technology and our seed usage, you know, if you think that, let's say North America, not including the South, right? Let's take the South out of it because they single seed sow everything anyways.
Yeah.
So North America minus the South, let's say it's a 2 billion tree industry. If their average germ is 80%, maybe it's higher, maybe it's 90%, and you're putting 2 seeds per cavity, well, that means we have 4 billion seeds that we used last year. Well, if we had better technology, instead of having only 2 billion trees to go out and plant, we'd have, 3.6? I'm sure that math is wrong, but, you know, we could have an extra 1.6 billion trees to go plant in the woods if we just didn't waste all of our energy or all of the seed and energy. I'm an Excel nerd. I don't know if you have met people like me in your path, but if there's some question that I have in my mind, I build an Excel document to tell me the answer. It doesn't matter what equations you use on seed usage. You can say that it takes 1.5 seconds to thin a tree, and it takes 1.5 seconds to remove that empty cell and put a new one back in there. I've timed it. It's not that far off. Well, you can save so much labor by not thinning trees and just removing blanks. Well, that stretches our national seed supply by, you know, huge numbers. You know, the numbers that we're using right now in the industry are ones where we're killing more trees than we're making. If we just stopped doing that one thing, the amount of seed we have would go so much further.
Like, that kind of reminds me of the food industry where I'm on lots of social media where they're talking about food waste and the mountains and mountains and mountains of food that were lost during COVID because the two streams never shall meet, the commercial versus the retail. And there again, we've lost millions of pounds of food because of just plain, I guess I call it stupidity. I'm sorry.
Yeah. you could call it a whole bunch of other things, but that's probably gets to the root of it.
And you think to yourself, if we can grow that much, we can certainly do the same for trees. We can grow and not have waste, as you're saying, because waste is, in the end, it costs everybody because it takes longer to get where we need to be.
Yeah. And I think, you know, now is the time. We now have people that are interested in this field, and we have people coming into this field that aren't from this field. And I think that's a good thing. We have a lot of outside perspective on things that we've been doing the same way. And I, you know, always hate that answer. Well, it's the way we've always done it. Well, you know, if that way sucks, then maybe we shouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah. I used to tell my students, I said, our industry will change when we get people from the outside in. Yeah. That's when our industry changes, and it will change for the better because they're going to see stuff that we don't see.
Yeah.
Or they're going to act upon things that we haven't acted upon.
Yeah. And we're finally at a point in time where we have technology to help solve some of these things. You know, we're making new trays that don't have circling roots, that we can be efficient with seed. You know, there's all of these things coming. So I think for the first time in my career, we could build a nursery today that is scalable. When you compare forestry and the world of horticulture, horticulture gets scale. One of the largest greenhouses in the United States is 230 acres. Acres, right? You need a golf cart with an extra battery just to drive the place. The largest forest nursery is not anywhere near that, right? It's, you know, fractional compared to that. But we can take the learnings of Hort and do it better. Because the one thing I've learned in working a lot in the Hort world is they may know automation, but a lot of times they automate the wrong things. You know, they automate moving a pot from here to there with no reason behind it. Whereas our industry is really focused on the science of it. So we're light years ahead of them in terms of dormancy and seed technology. The physiology of our plants, we know that so much better than the Hort world. And we pay so much more attention to roots. I always tell people I grow roots. The top comes for free. You know, you're like, you get the top for free because the root is the most important part of that plant. And if you get that root right, that tree will go to the woods and become a forest. You know, that is our goal, right? Foresters means we make forests. And we're good at it, and we can be better at it. And right now, you know, if someone asked me, we could build a nursery that you could grow a billion trees annually if you really wanted to. I think we could scale to that point and not kill people along the way, you know, not make everyone's life miserable.
You know, you just made me realize that trees have their head in the soil.
Yeah.
Which is the root system.
It is. It's the entire thing, right? We value the above ground just like Hort does, right? It's the pretty plant that you see at the store, but the roots are doing all the work. They're really the only important part that we're producing as nurserymen and women. It's really it. if you make a great root system, that plant, whether it's going on someone's countertop or out into the woods, is going to excel.
Our podcast this week talks about carbon sequestration. And he was saying, John Perlin was saying that the root systems are really what hold the carbon. It's not the top of the tree as much as it is the root systems. Yeah. Isn't that what he said? Right. Now?
Yeah. It's something like twice the biomass below ground, or more depending on the species.
Yeah.
So let's grow some roots.
I think the other...
I got my favorite sticker, which is Stay Rooted.
Lovely.
From a local brewery.
I love
the sticker so much. but it is. It's the roots. Everything revolves around the roots.
So everything you just said, we're coming to the end here, Michael, but I did want to acknowledge that I think there's been a significant wake-up call in the last year or so, particularly good media coverage of where large-scale tree plantings worldwide, zealously administered and executed, and then we've significant failures. I don't know who's doing the math and the calculations, but the numbers seem legitimate. And so I think the challenge on the flip side of the ledger is caring for newly planted trees on site on a macro scale, scaling up for that as well.
Yeah. We're at a point where we could make the nursery happen, and now we got to be able to make the planting happen. We have to get more efficient at that. We can't rely on throwing people at a problem to solve it. We're smarter than that. It's like, I'll just bring in 20 people and fix that problem. Those days are gone. You can't do that in a nursery anymore. You could call 5 people and you probably couldn't get 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be so much smarter with how we apply our resources. And we got to do that on the field side. And it's coming.
And that's why they fly you around all over the country to do what you do.
That's why I fly all over the country. Yeah.
So that's going
to
make
projects from New Brunswick all the way through the Midwest to the Northwest, down to the South. I don't spend a lot of time in the prairie lands, but I wasn't built for prairie lands. I was built for forests.
The prairies are doing a good job with their own carbon sequestration. So that might be a problem we want to leave alone.
Those desert plants and grasses, you can grow a lot of roots on those things.
Yeah, yes. The buffalo or the bison are helping quite a bit.
So you get to see so much of the North America. You'll be challenged then when we ask you what is your favorite tree.
And, you even prompted me that you were going to ask that question.
Yes.
I'm gonna say that I love finding that unique tree in every landscape. So, my phone is full of pictures of trees. My wife, my kids, and trees, lots and lots of trees. And one of the things that I like to do is every place that I go, you find that one, maybe it's a little bit twisted or crooked, but it just looks old and it's got those marks of age and wisdom on it. Those are the trees that I like. Those character trees. And I try to find those trees in every place that I go. You can find a little tiny bristlecone pine tree up at the timberline that's, 2 feet tall, or it could be some massive tree. I like the unique ones. I like the ones that are growing in really strange places, on that rock out in the middle of a river. So I don't have one tree that I really like. I just love trees.
I think that's a great...
I think it's a great answer.
Great answer, yeah. And it's the first time we've gone in the direction of it not being species specific.
Yeah.
I mean, we never said it had to be species specific.
No, we never did. And, you used an interesting characteristic of being twisted or bent or a little, and it has character. It's not that, it might not be that real straight one, or it might be that real straight one, depending on where you are.
Yeah, the straight ones don't have the character though, right? They're not like, you don't walk past a straight tree and go, that's a really great looking tree. You might if you, own a stud mill, you might be like, that's an amazing tree. I like the gnarly ones, the ones that got left by time. You know, the lagers never touched because it didn't have any value to them. Maybe it's got four tops. It's all busted up and broken, but it's unique and it's got character.
I think that answer also makes perfect sense for someone that with your work history and specialization, because you've seen enough of the plantation straight up and down trees laid out in the grid.
Yeah.
Please give me something with imperfection and distortion.
Yeah. Yeah, I do love those high desert pines, you know, that look like they've been there 1,000 years and got beat up by everything that came past it. Growing out the side of a cliff or
yes,
those ones are, you know, you just look at it and you're like, that is a tough tree.
Yeah. And right on.
It's probably got amazing roots.
And I was going to say, and if you put your ear to it close enough, you might hear a really fantastic story.
Oh, I'm sure there's great stories for sure. For sure.
Well, thank you so much for being on our podcast. We really appreciate you taking the time and giving us this wonderful background of what you do and what the industry and where it's headed.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity and the conversation and talking to people that love trees too.
Thanks so much for your time. It's been terrific and have a great weekend. And I say this to all our guests because they're always so phenomenal, but I hope I get to meet you in person sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm probably traveling past you at some point then.
Take care.
Thanks again, all right,
Michael.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Plant a Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromedan Recordings in Hollywood, California. Thank you.